You're traveling through another dimension. A dimension not only of sight and sound, but of mind. Journey into the wondrous land of boundaries of that of imagination. That signpost up ahead, your next stop, Twilight Zone Commentary.
And hello, welcome to Talking Twilight Zone, the Commentaries. I'm your host, Robert. And usually about this time, you would hear a review of an episode from the Twilight Zone, but Lynn and Bobby are moving from Seattle to Philadelphia, and at the time of this recording, I got a call from them. They are taking the Amtrak, and they are in Ohio. So they called and said everything was going well and should be hitting Philadelphia tomorrow as of this recording. So good luck with them, and safe journey through the rest of the way. And today, the commentary review will be It's a Good Life. Now, it's kind of interesting because I was checking when the last time I did a commentary for, and it was last year, December to be exact, last year. So it's been almost a year since I did a commentary. And I'm going to kind of do this one a little bit different. Where the episode that we reviewed, this was episode 73. It was our St. Paddy's Day show, and how appropriate it was to air that Saturday on St. Paddy's Day. So what I'm going to do is also I'm going to throw some clips from that show onto the commentary. So you'll hear Lynn, Bobby, Dave, and Rick Wall as well, and how they felt about the episode It's a Good Life as well. Now, before we get started with the talking of the episode, let's go and get a little introduction. Now, if you guys want to get a sandwich or something to drink, go right ahead, because, as I said before, this is a two-minute opening. So, here is the man himself, Rod Serling.
And now, Mr. Serling.
Tonight's story on the Twilight Zone is somewhat unique and calls for a different kind of introduction. This, as you may recognize, is a map of the United States, and there's a little town there called Peeksville. On a given morning not too long ago, the rest of the world disappeared, and Peeksville was left all alone. Its inhabitants were never sure whether the world was destroyed and only Peeksville left untouched, or whether the village had somehow been taken away. They were, on the other hand, sure of one thing, the cause. A monster had arrived in the village. Just by using his mind, he took away the automobiles, the electricity, the machines, because they displeased him. And he moved an entire community back into the Dark Ages. Just by using his mind. Now I'd like to introduce you to some of the people in Peeksville, Ohio. This is Mr. Fremont. It's in his farmhouse that the monster resides. This is Mrs. Fremont. And this is Aunt Amy, who probably had more control over the monster in the beginning than almost anyone. But one day she forgot. She began to sing aloud. Now the monster doesn't like singing, so his mind snapped at her and turned her into the smiling, vacant thing you're looking at now. She sings no more. And you'll note that the people in Peeksville, Ohio, have to smile. They have to think happy thoughts and say happy things, because once displeased, the monster can wish them into a cornfield or change them into a grotesque walking horror. This particular monster can read minds, you see. He knows every thought. He can feel every emotion. Oh, yes, I did forget something, didn't I? I forgot to introduce you to the monster. This is the monster. His name is Anthony Fremont. He's 6 years old, with a cute little boy face and blue, guileless eyes. But when those eyes look at you, you'd better start thinking happy thoughts, because the mind behind them is absolutely in charge. This is the Twilight Zone.
Well, that's a nice introduction. And then when we run the episode, you'll see that introduction again. You'll probably want to get a refill on your drink during that time. But it's always nice when we get a little more Rod Serling. So we will get ready to start with the episode.
Make sure you have your DVD or VHS or whatever. Yeah, people still watch stuff on VHS. Go past, if you got the Time Life version of the Twilight Zone, go past the intro there and get to the point where the music's just getting ready to start. And then press pause right there. So, if everybody's set up, let's get started. In 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, play.
And we're getting the opening theme here. Well, hope everybody got their sandwiches and ready to go here. While we're waiting for the introduction to go through here, just a little information for everybody here. Story is written by Russ Erling from the story It's a Good Life by Jerome Bixby, first published in 1953, collection Star Science Fiction Stories number 2. This was season 3, episode 8 of that season, production code 4801, and original air date was November 3rd, 1961. We have John Larch as Mr. Fremont. They have Cloris Leachman as Mrs. Fremont. Don Kiefer as Dan Hollis. Bill Mumy as Anthony Friedman. Alice Frost as Aunt Amy. Max Showalter as Pat Riley. Jeannie Bates as Ethel Hollis. We have Lenore Kingston as Thelma Dunn. Tom Hatcher as Bill Summers. Getting into the start of the story here. Having the food delivered to the house. Talking about the three-headed gopher. Wow. Yeah, just walk over eggshells. Wow. Yeah. Yeah, they all love him. You know, what's interesting about this was not only was Billy Mooney in this episode as well, he was also in another episode called Long Distance Call, which, of course, was another good episode that I like. And another one in Praise of Pip. He was in that episode as well. One of the kid actors that went on to do pretty well with his life on the episode 73, Talking Twilight Zone, Bobby mentioned how things seemed to work out for him and Ron Howard as well in their life. Bill Mooney, of course, was born in 1954, February, very first, 1954. He's an actor, musician, pitchman, and instrumentalist, voice actor, and a figure in the science fiction community. He is perhaps best known for his work as a child actor in film and television. He came to prominence in 1960 as a child actor, most noticeably as Will Robson, the youngest of the three children of Professor John and Dr. Maureen Robson, played by Guy Williams and June Lockhart, respectively, and friend of the notorious and pompous Dr. Zachary Smith, played by Jonathan Harris, in the 1960 CBS sci-fi television series Lost in Space. Later on, he appeared as a lonely teenager, Sterling North, in the 1969 Disney film Rascal, and as Tef in the 1971 film Bless the Beasts and the Children. In the 1990s, he had the role of Lanier, which is one of my favorite series, in the syndicated sci-fi TV series Babylon 5. He also served as a narrator of A&E Network Emmy Award-winning series Biography. He's also notable for his musical career as a solo artist and as half of the duo Barnes & Barnes. Well, as the commentary is going on, let's play one of the clips from episode 73, and let's hear from Lynn.
I mean, here's the whole deal here. It's a little kid who's got total control over his parents, total control over everything. He's a godlike creature who is evil. And, you know, and it reminds me of that movie Firestarter with Drew Barrymore. Mm-hmm. I mean, her character didn't have a whole range of powers that Anthony had, but she could start fires merely by thinking about it, like Carrie, you know, but the remake of this episode for 1983, Twilight Zone, the movie, that was very inferior for many reasons, and especially the ending. And now I'm sure everyone saw Twilight Zone, the movie, and they saw this remake. The kid who played Anthony actually had somewhat of a soft side to him, and you know, the special effects were silly, totally overdone.
They added a teacher character.
Right, yeah. Kathleen Quinlan, yeah. It was terrible. It was the worst thing, and it was almost a comedy. It actually was a comedy. It was
the
a comedy.
Only thing good was Bill Mooney as the father.
Yes, and he was in the diner right at the very very beginning.
Yeah.
And you know, I just wish people would leave these classic shows alone and stop trying to remake them. I mean, the writers need to come up with an original thought once in a while. Stop trying to remake things that shouldn't be remade. In 1980, it was the 2000 Twilight Zone series. They did do an episode of It's a Good Life, but it was a sequel called It's Still a Good Life. And I think everyone...
Continuation.
Yes, and the little girl, you know, she had his powers now. And that actually was one of the few, and I will say few, episodes from any of the Twilight Zone remakes from either the 80s or the 2000s that was any good. And I thought that was great, and his little girl did a fabulous job as the little girl had the powers. And, you know, that was the only, that was the only thing about any of the remakes that I liked. But, you know, 98% of those episodes stunk. So, grown-up Billy Mummy was in it, and his daughter, and old Cloris Leachman. I thought that was pretty good. But other than that, they need to leave our classics alone. And so with that being said, this episode, absolutely one of the great ones, and it will always get a 5. Classic rating from me.
And that was from Lynn there. Now they're getting ready for Dan's birthday party. And one of the questions we kind of wonder is why would they have a party at the house where Anthony was? We find out that Anthony don't like dogs and give a little bit of what I felt about this episode, too. This story must be one of the most referred to besides Time Enough at Last or The Monsters Are Due on Maple Street when comparing to other stories or movies or TV shows. It is very atmospheric, creepy, and scary, including the scene when a man is turned into a jack-in-the-box and the father tells Anthony to send it into the cornfield, which he does. There was a sequel made, as Lynn said, in 2002 called It's a Still Life, and we get Bill Mumy back as Anthony and Cloris Leachman back as his mother. In that story, Anthony is a middle-aged man who had a daughter named Audrey who inherited his powers, which is kind of strange. And I said, first of all, who would want to be with Anthony, or did Anthony create Audrey? Also, a remake, another, mentioned by Lynn also, of the story was in the Twilight Zone movie in 1983. I give it a 5 out of 5, classic rating. One of the comments that I made was the piano player and how much alike he looks like Mel Tremaine. And not only did I see that, but Lynn seen that as well. And it's sad, too, that the only television that they get is what Anthony makes up. And they'll have to clap and say, oh, that's great, Anthony. You're a wonderful boy, Anthony. You know, I should say that TV sucks. You see the tension with the piano player as Hollis gets his present, the Perry Como record and the drink, and you see as the time goes on. And another thing, too, is why would you give someone alcohol? You know how they're going to get, and the resentment towards Anthony. It's sad. It really is. Now, next, we'll have to see what Bobby feels about this story.
Anyway, so now we get this story, and it's a breath of fresh air to see a kid finally portrayed this way. And personally, I like kids, and I used to babysit a lot when I was a teenager. I never had any problems with them, but then nobody was like this. So this kind of took guts to put this on TV. It stands out because it's just so unusual. But you know what? Even so, it never would have worked without the right child actor in the part. And that brings us to Billy Mooney, who's, this is a bravura performance. It rivals those of Burgess Meredith in Time Enough at Last and Agnes Moorehead in The Invaders. It's that good. Mooney, one of the great kid actors of all time, along with Ron Howard, of course, makes this work like nobody else could. It would never work with anybody else. I don't think anybody had the ability then. I don't think anybody does today. That evil stare alone, to say nothing of that finger that he points at people without wavering a millimeter, is so disturbing. It makes you, you know, want to put yourself in the cornfield even before he sends you there. He takes it seriously. He's not trying. He may look cute in some respect, like the intro said, but he surely is not. And you really are disturbed by that. So he's different than every other person. And he's got a website now, which I posted on the message board at our group. 53 years in the business is quite remarkable.
He's pretty cool. Yeah, he's pretty cool right now. He's done a lot of CDs, and he's pretty awesome right now. I like the guy. I like him better as an adult than I did as a kid.
Well, I mean, I liked him as a kid. He was in other episodes, too. The one they showed on TV last night, what is that called, Lynn? The one where the grandmother's trying to...
Long distance call.
Yeah, he was good in that too because.
I didn't like him as a kid, but I'm saying as an adult, he's done a lot more, and he's a little bit more likable as an adult to me, anyway.
Well, he's worked since he was age four, so I mean,
exactly.
Worked for all those years.
He's never been out of the business. He and
Ron Howard simply rewrote TV. It's really quite remarkable. Anyway, about this episode, I gave it a 4.5. You know, in the poll, 4.5, 5, it's all the same. I just wanted to indicate that I had a couple of problems with it, but, you know, I think it's obviously one of the best ones. It's certainly, if I was writing up a top 10, it would be in that top 10. I don't know. I wouldn't put it in the top 3 or anywhere because I think there are ones that are more compelling than this, but still it's a very, very creepy and very disturbing episode, and it really is what The Twilight Zone is all about. So in that respect, it is a classic episode.
Very much agree with Bobby on that. A little more discussion here about Cloris Leachman. Now, she plays the mother in this episode. And, you know, Cloris Leachman, she's made a name for herself as well. She's born April 30th, 1926. Is an American actress of stage, film, and television. She's won 8 Primetime Emmy Awards, more than any other performer, and 1 Daytime Emmy Award. She co-starred in the 1971 film, The Last Picture Show, for which she won the Academy Award for Best Supporting Actress. Leachman's longest-running role was the noisy, self-centered, and manipulative landlady Phyllis Lindstrom on the 1970s TV series Mary Tyler Moore. Later on, the spin-off series Phyllis, she also appeared in 3 Mel Brooks films, including Young Frankenstein. She also had a regular role on the last 2 seasons of The Facts of Life, portraying the character Beverly Ann Sickle. In recent years, she had a recurring role as Lois' mother, Ida Gorsa, on Malcolm in the Middle. She also starred in the roast of Bob Saget in 2008. Leachman was a contestant on season 7, 2008, of Dancing with the Stars, paired with Corky Ballas, at the age of 82. She is the oldest contestant to have danced on the series. She currently stars as Mau Mau in the television comedy Raising Hope. Leachman was a grand marshal for the 2009 New Year's Day Tournament of Roses Parade and Rose Bowl game in Pasadena, California. She presided over the 120th parade, the theme being Hats Off to Entertainment, and the 95th Rose Bowl game. Leachman plays a supporting role in Raising Hope, a sitcom that premiered in the fall of 2010 on Fox. She starred with Tara Reid in The Fields and with Colin and Cameron Diaz in Gambit, a remake of a 1966 film. Uh-oh, now it's starting to hit the fan now. You're a bad man. You're a very bad man. Now let's hear what Dave has to say.
Atmospheric and well done. I think the way that this child dominated them, and the reason why in the opening reference it was said that this is like a little isolated town, they've basically been cut off. The thing about why this child could dominate them for so long and them not overpower him, if you remember, there's the one scene quite near the end where it suddenly starts snowing outside and the father's a little bit worried they're going to lose half the crop. But the point is, you don't hear the boy, you know, he doesn't point, he doesn't say anything out loud, because the father turns to him and said, are you doing that? Are you making it snow? And he says, yes. And the reason I think that is quite important, because it gives the reference to the fact that, you know, it's not as though they could grab him from behind, pin him down on the floor and put gaffer tape over his mouth, because he could still make these things happen just by thought, like
but
he made
mind.
It.
Well, yeah. pardon me for interrupting, but when he turns the guy into a jack-in-the-box, you don't have an opportunity right then to grab him right at that point?
Well, I think they were too horrified by that. I mean, that's what I would have thought. But you're right. I mean, the obvious thing is in the middle of the night when he's asleep, I suppose. One would assume there could have been a throwaway line where the parents defend him, you know, where, you know, like they have a secret meeting when the boy's out playing, they say, quick, come in the house, and they have a secret meeting, and the parents say, no, you think of something else, we'll do anything other than kill him, and that could have done it. But, of course, you've got the 23-minute, 22-minute limit. Of course, the playing the father, John Larch, he's been in a couple of others. He was in Perchance to Dream and
played that
sheriff in the not-too-brilliant episode Dust. But, of course, he's well-known for many other things. Chief of Police in Dirty Harry and a few other things. Quite a nice actor, really,
was he
indeed.
In Dirty Harry?
Yeah, he played the Chief of Police in Dirty
Harry. I didn't know that. Oh, I did not know that. Thank you, Dave, for telling me that. I didn't know that.
And thank God he's one of those ones that did live a little bit longer. When we did last week, so they all seemed to be dying off in their 60s. He lived till he was 91, died in 2005. But one thing that nobody, as far as I, unless I've drifted off in the middle of the show, has mentioned, the fact that probably one of the reasons why this is a good episode is because we've got a science fiction writer, a writer of short stories and an editor of a sci-fi magazine or periodical, Jerome Bixby, writing this episode.
And I do believe Dave, thank you, Dave, for that. He gave it a 4 out of 5, I do believe. And finally, we'll finish up with Rick Wall here.
Personally, I thought it was one of the better, best episodes. Scared the hell out of me when I was younger. Still kind of does. If I could add a couple of things. Like Bob was saying, there were and still are some scary episodes of other shows with kids. Like, anybody remember the episode of X-Files called Eve?
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
first
Robert
season.
Probably
yep.
does, yeah.
About the clones?
Yeah. There were a set of twins, actresses. They did such a great job playing creepy kids. It wasn't funny. Two young girls that scared the hell out
of me. Well, how about in The Shining? You had the two twin girls in The Shining.
Oh, yeah, that too. Yep.
Okay, there you go. There's creepy kids. Ooh, yeah, they give me the chills even thinking about them. Ooh.
Yeah, but this is the early 60s, and nobody in the early 60s dared to suggest that kids can be that evil. It's most unusual.
Oh, yeah.
Kids are evil. Kids can be very evil when they want to be. What's your rating, Rick?
Five. Before we get into another section. Five.
Oh, great.
And that was Rick Wall. He gave it a five. So that is finishing up the Twilight Zone. It's a Good Life episode here. And I hope everybody enjoyed the episode and the commentary that we had to go with it. The next one I will be reviewing will be called Kick the Can. So stay tuned for when we get ready to do Kick the Can. And I want to thank everybody for listening to this commentary. Take care, and we'll talk to you later. Goodbye, everybody.